What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
New revelations out. The U.S. military killed scores of women and children in a 2019 air raid in Syria and covered it up. Political tensions are rising in Tunisia. Opponents of President Saïd are protesting his policies just outside the parliament building. The Daesh terrorist group says it's been behind a deadly attack on a police headquarters in Pakistan. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The U.S. military has reportedly tried to cover up air raids that claimed the lives of scores of civilians in Syria 3 years ago. According to New York Times, the military officials went so far as to bulldoze the attack site and remove any mention of the strike in a subsequent probe.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Behrouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the botched strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
Well, we've talked to Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, about what this latest revelation means for the U.S. military presence in Syria. He says that there is only one solution to stop these indiscriminate attacks. Foreign occupation forces must leave West Asia.
This is just one of the ones that they admit. And as your report pointed out, there have been hundreds and hundreds of bombings in Syria. And it replicates, as your report said, what had been going on in Afghanistan for 20 years, what had been going on in Iraq, what was going on in Vietnam. So this is just really standard operating procedure for the US occupations of other countries. And as your report also said, there's a man in prison for revealing one of those drone strikes. And of course, let's remember there's Julian Assange in prison in England for revealing, amongst other things, one of the attacks, similar attacks in Iraq. So it's a constant phenomenon. The only answer to it is the evacuation, the exit of all of these foreign occupations. They have no idea of these countries. They bomb from the air. They don't know the culture. They don't know the people. They never deliver any benefits, as 20 years of war in Afghanistan pointed out, where the Taliban came back where they started. So the solution is to get all of these foreign occupations out of the countries of West Asia. There's no other decent solution.
Breaking news out of Tunisia, where people are turning out in force against the seizure of government powers by President Kais Saied. Well, right now, a large number of people are gathering outside of parliament in capital Tunis. They're demanding a return to the democratic path. Police are trying to push back the demonstrators, rushing toward the barricades. Tunisia has been a political turmoil for some time. Late September, Saied brushed aside much of the constitution, giving himself power to rule by decree. Just 2 months before that, he fired a prime minister, he suspended the parliament, and assumed executive authority. Now, opponents are accusing Saied of staging a coup d'etat. We have the president insisting that all he wants is to tackle his country's political and economic crises. Now, an Afghan family that has lost 10 members, including 7 children, in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul says this is still seeking justice and has yet to hear from the American officials more than 2 months after that tragic event. Our correspondent has more.
Ten innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises, as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajman's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them, and the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, just a day after a bomb attack that ripped through a police barracks in northern Pakistan, Daesh terrorists now saying it was their job. Police confirmed 2 officers were dead in the blast. 6 civilians, including a young girl, were also injured. It took place in Bajaur, that's a district near the border with Afghanistan. Daesh terrorists have claimed a string of bloody violence, including attacks on mosques in Afghanistan in the past months. But such attacks have been rare in Pakistan. No let-up in the Saudi violence against neighboring Yemen. More civilians losing their lives in the latest bout of attacks. 1 civilian is dead. 3 more got wounded in a fresh Saudi artillery attack on a border district in Sada province. The assault followed an airstrike on the province of Shabwa overnight. On that attack, were 4 civilians dead. Just a day earlier, 4 more Yemenis were killed in an air raid in Hodeidah. three of them were kids. Yemeni armed forces have been making major advances against foreign-sponsored militants in that western province. The Socialist Coalition's warplanes have targeted Yemen's western province of Hodeidah, killing at least four civilians, including three children. The attack was staged after Yemeni armed forces took control of vast areas in that province. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has the story.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, four civilians, including three children, were killed. Two others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeidah province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeidah Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldened Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The hackers back in action. Their target this time, the email system of the FBI. A huge number of spam emails have been sent out warning a cyber attack was taking place. The FBI says it's investigating the attack and that a compromised server is now out of service. The hacking has sparked a flood of calls from worried organizations seeking advice from the FBI. A cyber threat tracking company says at least 100,000 emails were sent out from the FBI account. U.S. government agencies have been hacked several times recently. One of the most high-profile among them was the SolarWinds attack last year that gave hackers access to classified data of several government agencies. While the Chinese and American presidents are getting ready for a virtual meeting, officials from the two sides do not seem to be backing away from their stances on Taiwan. Top diplomats from the U.S. and China have traded warnings over the phone. Antony Blinken says Beijing needs to stop military, diplomatic, and economic pressure against Taiwan and engage in, quote, meaningful dialogue to resolve issues peacefully. But Wang Yi wants Washington to change its dangerous actions that seem supportive of Taiwan's independence and harm peace across the strait. Washington has angered Beijing with its military support and diplomatic contacts with Taipei, most recently a visit by a group of lawmakers to the island. President Joe Biden and Xi Jinping will meet online for a discussion of their differences Monday. Conflict and poverty in parts of the world forcing many people to flee their home countries in pursuit of a better life. For the past years, asylum seekers and migrants have been seen embarking on hazardous journeys, but often let down by countries and governments calling themselves human rights defenders.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers, no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported, and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
That's a wrap for this edition.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Here at The Key and IRIB English Radio, we would like to offer our congratulations to our listeners on this most auspicious day of the birthday of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. Today on The Key, we would like to address a question that maybe pops up in the mind of people, and that's this. Some people say that according to some verses of the Quran and then the conduct and seerah of the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, it would appear that Islam in its genesis was not meant to be a global religion. It was initially meant to be a local religion limited to the Arabian Peninsula and perhaps even more limited to the people of Mecca, or some people even say to the tribe of the Quraysh, the tribe of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But only when the Prophet saw that this religion was being accepted by people outside of the parameters of his tribe and his city and even his land, did he change his mind? And when he attained certain political and acquired military power and political power, did he change his mind and decide to expand the the scope of his invitation towards Islam. We can answer this question by, first of all, taking a look at some of the verses of the Holy Quran. These verses of the Holy Quran, when we look at them in a historical context, we see that they were revealed in Mecca. In Mecca, when the Prophet still didn't have this political power and this military power, this person making this objection refers to. For example, in the following verse of the Holy Quran, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَأُوْهِيَ إِلَيَّ هَذَا الْقُرْآنَ لِأُنذِرَكُمْ بِهِ وَمَنْ بَلَغَ. This verse can be translated as in the following way. This Quran was revealed to me so that I could warn you, meaning warn the people of the Arabian Peninsula, and also warn whoever this message reaches. So in this verse, as you can clearly see, the second part of this verse, which says waman balag, meaning whoever this verse reaches, is meant to be someone who is warned by this verse, indicates the global nature of Islam from the very onset and its propagation by the Prophet and from the very onset of its genesis. This is one verse which can refute this objection or this misgiving. Another verse which is also very eloquent in this regard is the following. This verse says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Tabaraka alladhi nazzal al-furqan ala abdihi liyakuna lil-alamina nadhira. This verse is translated as follows. Blessed or sacred be the one, meaning God, who sent down the Quran, the Furqan, the discernment, upon his servant, so that it could be, or he could be, a warner to all the nations. In this verse of the Holy Quran, we see that God Almighty addresses the Prophet and tells him that Islam is also global in nature. Thank you for joining us on The Key. We were looking at the global nature of Islam. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where 1 in 4 have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and 1/3 of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. that was 15 years ago. Rue's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Rue required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor, her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that if someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Rue was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Rue has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Wu wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Wu's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Wu going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also are married to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. One in three victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter.
We don't know all the facts. There's another side of the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, okay, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. You know, I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically, we have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity, but in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in the family, right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, you know, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, you know, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, we could see on her face the black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, you know, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. You know, we could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and says, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the Batterwise syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, is still single, she did bring the subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and Dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son. Yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shuwei's beliefs, though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Brave enough.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Oh, I accept.
Mm. You are a role model. Mm.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening. So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, it's going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. Yeah. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a 3-year campaign, and we say, if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just a catalyst. We provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose. My change is to start believing in my self-worth. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? there's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good strong friends, friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is going to be. I don't care if that guy is going to use vulgarities on me. But I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point? You always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Perhaps breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, The merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners of this program, Lantern, so welcome. I invite you to listen to our today's story. There once lived a kind woman in a mountain. One fine morning, the woman was strolling along the mountain path. On her way, she saw a shiny stone in a stream. It was a beautiful stone, so she took it with her. After a few days, a traveler was walking along the same path when he felt very weak and exhausted. The woman noticed the traveler and offered him with food and a shelter on her modest hut for a night. The next day, when the man was getting ready to continue his journey, he noticed a shiny little stone in a drawer. At once, he knew that this stone was very rare and precious. The traveler offered to buy the stone from the woman, but the woman told him that he could have it for free without any hesitation. The man then thanked the woman and left rejoicing his good fortune. He knew the stone was worth a fortune to give him security for a lifetime. After a few days, the traveler came back to the woman and returned the stone. "I know how valuable this stone is, but I give it back to you in hope that you can give me something even more precious. Give me what you have within you that enabled you to give this precious stone to me," he said. "A beautiful heart can bring things into your life that all the money in the world couldn't obtain." Sayyid Baqir al-Qazvini.
We have to see marriage as a cornerstone. It's the basis on which you build your life, not something that towards the end of your struggles you come and you introduce into your life. That is not something that's really healthy. Having said that, my dear brothers and sisters, let's now examine what are some practical ways for our generation, the generation of our youth today, to get to know one another, to find the appropriate and the right spouse. Now, traditionally, if you look back at traditional societies, oftentimes marriages were arranged. You probably heard of many stories of arranged marriages. In fact, the youth of the past, they did not have to worry about finding a person, because either your tribal leader was doing it for you, or your great uncle was doing it for you, or your great grandfather, or your parents. In fact, most of them even had no say in it. In fact, many of them did not even know who their spouse was until the actual marriage or the engagement ceremony. You know, recently a friend told me an interesting story about how his parents got married. And he said, "My mother did not know my father until that last minute when the marriage was taking place." And in fact, she was standing before all these guys in that part of the world, in that culture, and she's not even knowing who's going to come up, who out of this bunch is going to be her husband. And suddenly one of them popped out of nowhere, he came, and that was her husband. This was common in the past. In most societies around the world, marriages were arranged, but not today, my dear brothers and sisters. And by the way, a lot of those marriages were by force, which Islam completely rejected. Islam says that marriage, in order for it to be valid, it must be by the consent of both parties. No daughter, no son can be forced into a marriage. If the daughter says, "No, I don't give my approval," Islam says that is not a valid marriage. And many parents force their children into invalid marriages, unfortunately. In the end, they have to consent. It must be out of their willingness. Now, in our modern time and age, this in most societies does not apply. But we can take, my dear brothers and sisters, one takeaway point from these arranged marriages. And one practical point that we can take, and this is not something that you will hear people in Western societies discussing, but it really is a practical solution. The first area I would start looking at, if I wanted to get married, is to start by asking your mother and sister. This is something we don't normally do. No, we're not talking about an arranged marriage here. But your mother knows you. She knows a lot of people in society. The first area, the first circle to look for is to ask your mother. Mother, I feel I'm ready for marriage. I know you know a lot of people in your community, in your society. You have friends here and there. Is there anyone whom you recommend? This is not something that American culture teaches you. But my dear brothers and sisters, this is a very effective way. Ask your mother. She has experience. There may be people on her mind. Seeking her advice is extremely beneficial. Then you move on to other family members, like your sister. Your sister has friends. She's gone out with them. She knows many of them. She probably knows of a few good candidates, a few good options for you to get married. Go to your sister and ask her. Don't be embarrassed and say, no, I'm not going to ask my sister to introduce me to someone or give me an idea of someone else. This is completely fine. It's very practical, and it does actually work, my dear brothers and sisters. So the first circle that you should be looking at is your own family members. Ask them for advice. Oftentimes, you will find that they actually have good advice for you, and they can introduce you to good people in the community. Now, there are two common methods we're finding today in our society. Are these methods healthy methods? One method that we're finding today is social media. Many of our youth are going to social media in order to find the appropriate spouse. This sometimes does work. I don't deny that. You've probably heard of some success stories of people who got married. Alhamdulillah, now they have a great marriage. And when you ask them, how did you get to know one another? It was probably on social media. Instagram, Facebook, one of these social media platforms. But my dear brothers and sisters, many concerns do come with trying to find someone on social media. Many times it does not work. It's not worth the hassle that you have to go through, because you really don't know whom you're dealing with. I've known youth who've spent months and years with someone whom they got to know on social media, trying to discover that personality, trying to know whether this person was good for them or not. And then in the process of trying to discover that, they formed emotional attachments. And then after a year, 2 years, they discovered, you know what? This is not the person I thought he or she was. Now you're in emotional pain. Because emotionally you invested in this person. And now there's emotional suffering. That's not really the most practical way to go about finding a spouse. It may work. But the hassle that it brings you, and the success rate of it is very low, it just simply makes it not a practical solution for many of our youth. Yes. Social media is good for one thing, my dear brothers and sisters. If you're interested in someone and you would like to get a better understanding of their personality, of their behavior, go look at their social media. That's actually a good thing. You know, today, in many companies, when someone comes and applies for a job, before they even get interviewed, you know what the boss does? They go and they see their Facebook page, their Instagram page, their Twitter, to get an idea of what kind of person is this. Am I dealing with a serious person here? Or this is a goofball coming and applying for this job? Is this a respectful person or not? From their comments, from what they like, you will get an idea. I'm not saying a full idea, but you will get an idea of that personality. So social media is a good indicator of what kind of a person this is, if you're interested in someone and you're doing research. But for you to go and get to know someone through social media, that is not really the most practical way. Another dimension of that, my dear brothers and sisters, is Muslim matchmaking sites. They're becoming more popular, and more youth are actually considering the idea of getting to know someone through one of these matchmaking sites. Is this something practical for our youth? I don't see, based on my experience with most families, that this is still a practical way. A lot of youth are still reluctant because this kind of resembles dating websites, and they're not really comfortable taking that route.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.